Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
From The Cut and Gimlet Media, this is The Cut on Tuesdays. I'm Stella Bugbee, editor-in-chief of The Cut. For the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be filling in for Molly. She's on assignment for the magazine. And this is a good excuse for me to talk to some women I admire for our series, How I Get It Done. If you're not familiar, it's about ambitious women and how they live, how they deal with their inboxes, people's feelings, their grocery shopping, their morning routines. What do they know that we don't? What do they do that we can steal? It's part advice column, part love letter, part voyeurism. This week, I'm talking to the cook and food writer Allison Roman. I find myself reaching for Allison's cookbook all the time. Because the food is delicious, yes, and it's easy to make, yes, but also because Allison is funny and fun. Her recipes have names like shrimp in the shell with garlic and probably too much butter. An official step in that recipe is to pluck a hot shrimp out of the skillet, rip it apart, and suck the juices out of its head. In the picture, the shrimp are piled on a plate next to a can of Modelo beer. It doesn't look precious or perfectly styled. It looks like something you want to dig into and eat right away, messily. That's the kind of food Allison loves to make. And it's the kind of food a lot of people love to eat, too. Allison's first book, Dining In, was a huge success. These days, she writes about food for the New York Times, and she's got a second cookbook coming out in the fall. And her recipes have made her sort of an internet sensation. People fall in love with her food. They develop opinions about it, and sometimes they get pissed off about it, too. It feels personal to them. Allison says she found her distinctive cooking style while she was working at Bon Appetit. After years as a pastry chef in high-end restaurant kitchens, she'd landed a job at Bon Appetit as a recipe tester. And in the beginning, the stuff she was making was very different from what I now think of as Allison Roman food.
One of the first stories that I did was about pie, and one of the pies was like this hilariously complicated pie with plums. It was like you made a crust and then you made this filling that had to set and chill, and then you had to roast plums, and then you had to put the plums on top of the filling and stack them just so it looked really dramatic and beautiful. And I had a vision for this pie, and it was going to be so cool and impressive. And it was cool and impressive, but it was also so complicated, and not one human on the planet would make it. Like, I know that now. And at the time, I think what I was trying to do was showcase what I could do and impress people and entice people to want to make something because it looked cool and impressive. And now I realize that is not the way to get somebody to cook something. And kind of grappling with that, I think that also comes from working in a restaurant and me feeling insecure that my friends in the restaurant were going to think that I was making home-cooked food, which is less cool than restaurant food and less impressive. And, you know, there's a lot of insecurity about coming from that place. But my instincts have shifted dramatically since I first began.
I think that the food that I grew up idolizing, like the Martha Stewart way, sounds like a pie like you just described.
It is, yes.
So there seems to be like a real cultural break with what you're saying, and maybe it's generational, but I have found your cookbook and the new Bon App and, you know, Healthyish and all these new websites to be much more of a way in.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have, like, what were your inspirations when you were growing up? Was it Martha? Was that where you were looking at?
I didn't, like, open a Martha Stewart book until, like, 7 years ago, maybe, honestly.
What did you think when you opened it?
I was like, oh, this bitch is crazy. And I was like, I literally was just kind of like, no one's going to do that. Or rather, I'm not going to do that. And I think that there used to be a type of person that would, and they were your food friend or your mom's best friend or your aunt or your mom or whoever, your dad. And that was their thing. And they spent their time and their energy and their effort on these things. And that was sort of their identity. And now people can do a million other things and still have that desire to cook and to have people over and to do all those things. But it's not necessarily their identity.
You have a very distinctive visual style as well as a distinctive taste in food and a sound to your writing. Where did the visual style, you know, evolve from?
For me, I think it just came from being inundated with images and kind of reacting to that and thinking, like, I don't want to do that. And I think that that is how I make a lot of my decisions. I feel like I know what I don't want before I know what I do want. I feel like that's pretty common, probably. But I feel like it was a reaction to food and cooking being depicted in a very serious or perfect way, sometimes serious, sometimes perfect, sometimes both, where you look at an image of food and you're like, why am I in a dungeon? Like, why do I look like I'm in, like, you know, a castle in 18th century London? Or why is this look so, like, nobody's cooked here? Or why are there, like, a handful of blueberries scattered on this table? Like, why are they there? And so I really wanted the food that I was putting in my books to look like my actual life, which it does. So I cook all the food in the books. There's no food stylist. It's me just cooking the food. And I think that helps a lot. Just kind of, this is how the food should look. I'm actually cooking it. And if there's a messy thing on the counter, it's there for a reason, not because I, like, scattered a dusting of flour to make it look like I was cooking. Like, I actually was cooking, and that's why it's there.
So I love food, and I love your food.
Thank you.
One of the reasons I was always afraid to go into food as, like, a life was that I would eat all the time.
Yeah.
Do you eat all the time?
Yeah, your fears are true. They are correct. Sometimes the first thing you eat in the morning is, like, a piece of cake because you have to try it, or like a duck leg, or, you know, like a rib roast. I don't know. It's, like, not always the first thing you want to eat in the morning. So it is kind of a constant eating, but you're constantly tasting. Like, I feel like most people can relate to this when you're cooking Thanksgiving or, you know, a big meal and you're cooking all day. By the time you sit down, you're like, I don't want to eat any of this.
So take me through a typical day.
Oh, God.
Do you have a typical day?
I don't have a typical day. Because of the phase that I'm in right now, where I've just finished this cookbook, I don't know what I'm, I feel like I'm a lost girl at sea. I don't know what my days are going to look like.
So when you're working on a cookbook, what's your process like?
It is a crazy all over the place process. So basically for a cookbook, I start by concept. Okay, what is this book about? And then I kind of work backwards from there of what food do I want to put in this book? And I draw up like a dream table of contents. And then I start cooking through those recipes. So I think of a title that sounds delicious to me. I'm like, oh, I would eat that. I don't know what it is yet because I've never made it, but that sounds good.
Can you give me an example of something like that?
Yeah, there's a dish in Nothing Fancy that's like a Dutch oven, like one pot chicken with caramelized lemon and dates. I was like, that sounds good. Never had it. Don't know. I just, that idea of like a kind of golden brown chicken, but like braisy and fall aparty on the bottom.
A little acid, like, little sweetness.
Yeah, a little like brothiness in the bottom. I was like, that sounds, I want to eat that right now. And kind of
workshopping
that.
So you have an idea for like something like that. Do you immediately go out to the store and buy the ingredients? Like what, then what happens?
No. So I will batch them. So I know, okay, I have a month and a half, 2 months to cook all these things or 3 months, however it works. And I cook probably anywhere from 4 to 6 days a week.
For how many hours a day?
Depends. Sometimes 2, sometimes 7, sometimes 10. Sometimes it's all weekend. Sometimes, it, you know, it kind of fits into my schedule. I like to have people over when I'm doing this, so I have somewhere for the food to go.
In your own kitchen?
In my own kitchen, or if we're away for the weekend or something like that, like an Airbnb.
I'm, like, always available.
Great. I will absolutely add you to the roster.
Yeah.
It is, people honestly would get fatigued. They're like, I cannot come over and eating anymore. But so I order groceries online. I go to the farmer's market. I go to the grocery store. I order stuff. And I kind of have my to-do list in the way of, like, I'm going to cook these 5 recipes today.
And then are you tweaking as you go along?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So sometimes I have to cook things once and I'm like, that's great. Sometimes I have to cook things 3 times and decide it's actually not going to go in this book. It's not that good.
And do you use the feedback from your people that you subject to your food?
I do. But when you start to listen to so many other people about what your work should be, it becomes very muddied. And if I eat something and I'm like, fuck, that is so delicious and I cannot wait to eat the rest of this, then I don't really feel like I need somebody else to weigh in on it.
I think that when you're a writer, you think about who you're writing for. Do you ever think about, like, who your ideal taster, cook type of person, reader would be?
For me, the end goal has always been to get as many people cooking as humanly possible.
Why?
Because cooking is really fun and it's really empowering and it's just like a very pure act. And I think that I feel like there are very few things in this world that we can participate in that we have control over. For me, it's probably originates with control, which is probably why I cook in the first place. But that we can control that don't involve other people or technology or the internet. And when you make something, you eat it and it's good. That is a very pure sort of life cycle. There's no drama. There's no, I don't know. It's an uncomplicated ritual and it's like a beautiful thing that you can do that is not riddled with like, is it good? Is it bad? Can we rip it apart? Like, it's just food and it should be enjoyed. And I think that it's sacred for that reason.
And yet your recipes do come under a tremendous amount of scrutiny.
Exactly. That, I mean,
especially on the internet.
You would think that it is just a
pure thing. You've made some serious controversies happen.
I have, yeah.
Do you want to tell me a bit about that experience?
Oh, Stella, yeah. So you may be familiar with the cookies. In my first cookbook, there was a recipe for a salted butter chocolate chunk shortbread cookie. And
I believe The Cut actually had a controversy
exactly, yes,
with you
exactly.
about these cookies. So thank you for coming on despite our
no,
beef.
No, I do not turn away in the face of controversy. I lean into it. And this recipe became really popular on the internet. I did nothing to proliferate this. I did not champion it. It just kind of took off and people really loved it and they started baking it. And it was great. Like, what could be bad about that? It's a cookie. It's like a six ingredient.
It's like salt and butter and chocolate.
Yeah, it's
and flour.
Literally just a lovely thing that exists in the world. It is nice. It is a cookie. And the amount of popularity and praise was so beautiful and overwhelming until it wasn't, because then people started to be like, is it even that good? But is it good? Like, people love it, but do they? It's like, oh my God. So I think that is when you know you've made it. Is when people are
when people hate
giving
your
you
chocolate
shit
chip
about
cookies.
A cookie. Yeah. Like, there was another article on Food 52 that was like, is it even a shortbread that doesn't have powdered sugar? And I was like, listen, I considered adding powdered sugar, but I didn't want a seventh ingredient. And it's not a shortbread in that sense. It's a shortbread in this sense. And if you look up the classic shortbread recipe, it actually doesn't have powdered sugar. Like, I have thought all of that through. But again, it's...
But how did that feel? Like, so it must have felt really good to get all that praise. And think, oh my God, I made a hit.
Yeah.
And then how did the backlash actually feel?
It felt really bad. It felt really, really bad because I feel like people were trying to contribute to a conversation that didn't need to happen. And to my earlier point about food and cooking and baking just being like one of the last nice things we have on this planet that is just a pure, enjoyable thing, people were trying to turn it into something negative. And just for the sake of...
How did you mitigate your emotions about that? Like, having been, you know, on the other end of controversy, let's say on The Cut, like, those things, I internalize them. I'll just say
totally.
I internalize them for weeks and months. It's very hard for me to process and externalize. How did you kind of work through it? Like, I know you answered a lot of your critics and you did not back down.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what was going through your mind in those moments?
Well, for that one, it was different because I didn't actually think there was criticism to be had. And I felt prepared to, like, answer things. And in retrospect, I feel like I can be maybe a little too fiery or responsive. And I should maybe not. I don't know if I should give in to those impulses, which is to argue or to kind of answer or justify. If somebody cooks something and they're like, I didn't like it, not for me, great. That's totally fine. And I have nothing to say to you and I will never try to argue differently. But if you come at me questioning like the integrity of my development process or the origins of something or my intentions, that's when I take it really personally because I care very deeply.
Were you always like this?
Oh, yeah.
Even as a child?
Whole life. Yeah. I'm like this in every facet of my life, 100%.
I mean, it sounds like you're pretty confident in your own ideas about what tastes good to you, what makes sense to you. Was that something you started this process with?
Absolutely not. No. And even sometimes still, with pretty much everything other than food, I question and I rip it apart and it's terrible.
Coming up after the break,
Allison and I learn to embrace our inner control freaks.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
This week on The Gray Area, writer Derek Thompson makes his case that everything has become a cult. Well, almost everything.
Is Taylor Swift the closest thing we have to a mass cult today?
No. I think she's the closest thing we have to Christianity. It's
me. Find out if you're in a cult this week on The Gray Area, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the streaming wars. And there's a new docuspecial on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
Welcome back to The Cut on Tuesdays. This week, I'm talking with Allison Roman. In the last few years, Allison has become a major presence in the food world. Her recipes go viral, her Instagram followers adore her. She makes it look fun, but it hasn't always been easy. Something she learned coming up through restaurant kitchens.
People are so busy that they're not going to go out of their way to be like, oh, let me teach you how to do this thing. You have to observe and you have to learn and you have to watch and you kind of have to teach yourself and you kind of have to ask, I want to do that job. I want to do that thing. If there's an opening, let me have it. Mm. And that is sort of like restaurant culture and restaurant mentality that I took with me outside of restaurants.
Is there anybody that you look up to and think, oh gosh, if I could have that career or if I could, you know, just make a recipe as iconic as X? Like, is there anybody like that? You don't have to admit who it is.
Yeah, there's definitely, I think, a hodgepodge of qualities from different people. There's not one person that I'm striving to emulate or whose career path I feel like I am on or have been on or want to be on, which makes things challenging but also fun. But it became hard because this is like a new development also, because for a while, all I wanted to do was get a job at a restaurant. And then all I wanted to do was move to New York. And then all I wanted to do was, you know, X, Y, and Z. And I think that that's where we find ourselves at some point in our lives, where we reach a point where we're like, oh, I've done all the things that I knew I wanted. And now I'm at the place where I don't actually know what I want. I know I want to keep going in some direction, but that's part of doing something new, is that there's not a roadmap and there's not like, oh, I'm just going to ask this person how they did that.
I feel exactly the same way.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Do you have like an existential crisis at that point?
Yeah. I had a really tough few months actually this past year. As I was working through that second book, I was just like, what am I doing? Where is this going? And I had to kind of like recalibrate and be like, okay, I need to make time to answer that question.
And did you?
No, but I think that understanding that like where I'm at right now is okay, actually. And if I take stock of all the things that I do have, which is so much, that I'm actually really happy. And that'll probably last for like 5 minutes. And then I'll be like, I need more. But I think we don't really take time to acknowledge the things that we have accomplished when we've achieved that level of like, okay, well, now what? Because it's that goal that propels us.
Do you think you're, this is like a question I'm projecting, but do you do you think that you're addicted to that adrenaline feeling of producing a new thing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I feel like that's...
Does it scare you to step off the treadmill?
100%. Even yesterday when I was in my publisher's office and we were looking at the manuscript, she's like, it's going to the printer on Tuesday. She's like, I don't need anything else from you. And I was like, oh, great. What a relief. And on my way home, I was like, well, if I'm not working on that, what am I doing? And then I started firing off all these emails to people being like, hey, we should connect on this thing. And hey, we should have a meeting about doing something X, Y, and Z. And it's like, oh, my God, what if I just took the rest of that day to be proud of myself for finishing a book? But I do think, and this is something that I talk about with my therapist a lot, of using that, my anxiety and my whatever you want to call it as a way to...
I would call it drive.
Yeah, drive to do more. And it's like a thing that I think people who have it, I'm projecting, that allows us to achieve those things, but I complain about it.
You mentioned before about food being about control. Mm. At what point did you come to that realization? And was that through therapy?
Less so through therapy, more so through getting older and just realizing the way that I interact with food, especially as it relates to other people. And like if you were to have me over to your house, I would feel deeply uncomfortable if I didn't have something to do. Mm-hmm. I would be like, what can I do? Can I help? You want me to do something? And it's not because I need to control the food, but it's like I need to like control what it is that I'm doing or something. And that's...
Do people ever tell you need to chill?
Yeah, all the time.
And
all
how does that feel? Like, what's your reaction?
People love to be told to chill out. It's like our favorite
worst
thing. Yeah, or like relax. Oh, we love it. I remember actually growing up, my grandmother was the same way. And she wasn't a great cook or anything, but my dad would be like, Mom, just sit down. She's like, oh, I can't sit down. I can't sit down. And that I'm her. That is me now.
I'm coming to the place in my life where I'm like, I'm not going to calm down and stop telling me to calm down.
Yeah, like, stop telling me to calm down.
Yeah, or like, I'm okay with just being the person who's going a little crazy all the time.
Yeah, I'm not a chill person.
Right.
I will never be a chill person. So stop telling me to chill out. That's not going to happen.
Right.
But the control thing is weird. And I think that it occurred to me, I kind of had like an epiphany. I was like, oh, I need to be in control of all the situations in my life. And that's a really easy way for me to do it. In the same way when we get a haircut or it's like, should I get bangs? You know, it's like you need to control something right now. I can control that.
I really like this thread, by the way. I really love that we've gone from talking about recipe development to like control.
Same. Yeah. Yeah.
So part of releasing a recipe is like releasing control. Like you had the stew and you released it and you lost control of that conversation.
I did. It kind of took on a life of its own. And that's actually really interesting.
Well, actually, for anyone who is not aware of the stew, maybe explain the stew.
So the stew is a recipe that I published in the New York Times in October of 2018. And it is a spiced chickpea stew. There's chickpeas, there's garlic, there's ginger, coconut milk, turmeric, leafy greens. And it became as popular, if not more popular than the cookies. And that was a real trip to me because that is like a more complicated, not even that complicated, but it was less recognizable, more.
It's an like, odd stew.
Yeah. It's just like a pot of brown, like, or I guess they're golden yellow chickpeas. And people just like went absolutely crazy for it. And I will say in both of these cases, I like feed the flames and I fan the flames, feed the flames. I feed them.
I think you can fan and feed.
Great. Well, I'm doing both. If somebody's making it, I repost it or I share it and I encourage people. And I think when somebody else sees something, somebody doing something, you want to do it too, if it looks good anyway. But I also think part of it is that the recipe works and it was delicious, whatever. And then there was backlash with the stew.
What was the backlash?
The backlash was, is it even a stew? Is it a stew? There was like an absolute garbage piece written by somebody that was like, if people are... This is something that I want to talk about, actually. Buckle up. So I think when it comes to criticism, I accept it and I take it, especially if it in regards to something not working. If I publish a recipe and it doesn't work, I am mortified. And it's happened before. It'll probably happen again. And I am so sorry to anyone who's ever cooked something that didn't work. That was my fault. But part of why I love making recipes, and this kind of ties into that control thing, is that I make something and publish it the way that I would want to eat it or cook it. And then what I often like to do is say, if you don't like spiciness, take out the chili flake. If you don't have kale, use mustard greens. If you are vegan, take out the yogurt, et cetera. I want you to feel in control as well. I don't want to be told what to do. I'm pretty sure you don't either. So if you can read something, be inspired to cook it, but also know that I can change it based on my preferences. That, to me, is the best thing about cooking and why we cook and why I want you to cook. So this person had started to observe that a lot of people that were making the stew were putting their own spin on it. They were saying, oh, I made the stew, but I used Swiss chard instead of kale, or I made it vegan, or I used half the can of coconut milk, or I tripled the amount of ginger, or whatever. I love it. It's great. So this person who wrote the article was like, if the stew is so good, why are people doing it differently? Like, if it's such a good recipe, why are people making changes to it? And I was just like, oh my God, who paid you to write this? I'll pay you double to not write it because it's garbage. Because that's not actually an interesting thought. I think as a cook, part of the joy is to adapt and twist and make it your own and feel empowered and connected to the recipe writer like you're having a conversation, not like this is the stew and it's the only way to make it. If you don't do it this way, you're stupid. So that really got me fired up. And I responded to that as well. And I had a friend be like, you know, you shouldn't really respond to all these like negative people, da 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 da. And I was like, you think I'm responding to all of them? I respond to a tenth of negativity.
Do you feel better afterward?
With that instance, kind of. People are really supportive. I think it's like watching like a train wreck when they're like, oh, Allison's upset. but ultimately, no. And I think that's why that's the last time that I've clapped back, if you will.
Have there been opportunities since?
Oh, yeah. There's always opportunities. I think any person who puts themselves on the internet, there's an opportunity. And sometimes it's fun to just kind of respond to somebody, especially if you know it's like not rooted in reality. But most of the time, you kind of have to protect yourself and just be like, I'm not going to even, I don't read the comments ever about anything because I know they would just destroy me. I'm not strong enough for that.
Mm-hmm.
Fragile.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
The best piece of advice I've ever been given is from a woman who was my editor when I first started working at Bon Appetit. She's now one of my very close friends. I remember I had started writing more or wanting to write more. And so the magazine was kind of just like, if you want to write more, just pitch the website, because who cares about the website? Yeah, a different time. And so she was in charge of fielding all of my like very awful pitches. And one of them was like, I want to teach people how to ferment cucumber at home or something. I don't know, something dumb about fermenting. And she's like, okay, don't take this the wrong way, but who cares? And I was like, shit, that is so harsh, like way harsh, Ty. But she's like, I don't mean it in the way of like, who cares, to be rude, but you have to understand when you're pitching something, you have to ask yourself, who cares? Who's reading this and who cares about it? And at the time, you know, maybe three people cared about that. And she was in the business of growing a website and understood that that was an important question to ask yourself when you were writing for the internet. And I think that that is advice that anyone could take at any point. If you're at a dinner party and you're about to say something out loud, or if you're writing an article or putting a recipe in a book or whatever, you have to ask yourself, who cares? And if sometimes the answer is just, I care, and that should be enough. But at that time, even I didn't even really care.
Right.
So like, why would I publish it? And so I always like to say, who cares?
That's it for this week's show. I'll be filling in for Molly again next week. See you next Tuesday. Cut on Tuesdays is produced by Sarah McVee and Olivia Natt. Our senior producer is Kimmy Regler. We're edited by me, Stella Bugby, and Lynn Levy. Mixing by Jonathan Roberts. Our music is by Emma Munger and Haley Shaw. Our theme song is Play It Right by Sylvan Esso. That's Amelia Meath, Nick Sanborn, Molly Sarlay, and Alexandra Sauser-Monig. If you want to support The Cut's work on and off the mic, you can do that by subscribing to newyorkmag.com. Just go to thecut.com/subscribe. That's thecut.com/subscribe. We'd really appreciate it. Cut on Tuesdays is a production of Gimlet Media and The Cut.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.